Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 10 years ago today, President George W. Bush announced military operations to, quote, disarm Iraq, free its people, and defend the world from grave danger, end quote. On March 16th, 2003, Vice President Dick Cheney said, quote, we will be greeted as liberators. I think it will go relatively quickly, weeks, rather than months. Well, here we are 10 years later. According to Opinion Research Business, a polling group in Britain, more than 1 million Iraqis have died since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Almost 5 million people, one in six Iraqis, fled or were forced from their homes following the invasion. At least 1 million have yet to return, and there are still about 1 million internal refugees in Iraq today. On yesterday's show, we asked Iraqis to reflect on the 10-year anniversary. Their voices are still missing from most media coverage. Today, we are talking about the true costs of the war. When the Bush administration invaded Iraq, it said the cost would be between $50 and $60 billion. On November 15, 2002, then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said the war would last 5 days or 5 months, but it certainly isn't going to last longer. He also said that the cost would be around $50 billion. Well, the Costs of War Project recently released the human and budgetary costs of the Iraq War. The Costs of War Project is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, scholarly initiative based at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. The report has been compiled by more than 30 economists, anthropologists, lawyers, and political scientists. And it found that the war has cost $1.7 trillion so far. And when you factor in benefits owed to soldiers along with interest, the total cost could grow to more than $6 trillion over the next 4 decades. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by looking at the costs of the war. How is this war being paid for? Why aren't these astronomical numbers being discussed, especially as we're in the middle of a heated debate about the budget? And what about the hidden costs of the war? Joining us to discuss these issues is Nita Crawford, professor of political science at Boston University and co-director of the Costs of War Project. Hi, Nita. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Professor Linda Bilmes. She's a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard University. Her research focuses on budgets and public administration, particularly on the cost of war, veterans affairs, and civil service. Her recent books include the New York Times bestseller, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, which she co-authored with Professor Joseph Stiglitz. Hi, Linda. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And Linda, I want to start off with you because you've been on the show many times over the years. And I'm just wondering, as today is the 10-year anniversary, how are you reflecting back on 10 years of war?
Well, I think that we have been surprised at the fact that our costs that we knew were going to be high have turned out to be even higher than we had anticipated, and particularly in terms of the cost of those who have fought for the war, which were not forecast at the beginning of the war. I think that anyone who is familiar with the situation at all has watched the specter of veterans waiting for long periods of time to secure disability benefits. And this is because of the very, very large number of those who have fought in the war and come back injured or disabled in some way, and who are now dealing with a sort of a second war at home.
And what about you, Nita? As we mark the 10-year anniversary, how are you reflecting back on 10 years of war?
Well, I think of the ways that the press was not checking on the arguments made by the Bush administration that led to the sort of undertaking of war without much reflection on what its long-term consequences could be. That's not surprising in a sense because usually people defer to the executive in times of crisis, but there was no crisis here. We could have actually reflected more carefully on undertaking the war. And the other thing I think about is the unintended consequences of the war, the unintended strategic consequences. For instance, the fact that terrorism grew in Iraq. There was no such thing as al-Qaeda in Iraq before 2002, 2003, and now there is such a thing.
Well, and we're going to talk about media coverage this Friday. We're going to dedicate the entire show to media coverage. So tell us a little bit about costs of war, this massive project. Talk about how this started, and how did you manage to get such a wide range of people to work on this project?
Well, there was a sense that in 2010 that we should have a reflection on not just the budgetary costs or the human toll in terms of American soldiers' lives, which is important enough, but to try to get a sort of larger sense of what the 10-year anniversary of the start of the war in Afghanistan would yield in terms of our understanding. And then secondly, we enlarged the project to include this anniversary, and we'll look forward, too, to the end of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. The reason why we needed a team that was so varied in its talents, from physicians to economists to anthropologists to political scientists and so on, was that the costs of any war are multiple, and they span different spaces and ripple across time as well. So you needed to have people who could project economically forward, but also to look at the long-term health costs.
And Linda, you have been following this so closely over the years. We've had you on to talk about your book, The $3 Trillion War. What are your thoughts about the fact that when we're having this major debate about the budget and deficits, and we're seeing states across the country strapped, social services just decimated, that the costs of the war are hardly part of that conversation?
Well, I think that that's right. We don't do a very good job in the federal government of estimating long-term costs, and that includes the long-term cost of pensions, the long-term cost of Social Security and Medicare obligations. And one of the features of war, and particularly veterans' cost, is that it peaks a very, very long time in the future. For example, peak year for World War One cost was in 1969. That's 50 years after the armistice. And the peak year for World War II cost was in the late 1980s. So we're just beginning to grow into sort of peak years for paying for Vietnam veterans, and that will go on for another 20 years. So when we think about the cost of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, people tend to think that we're drawing down and the cost will actually come to an end. But in fact, we're just starting. We've only seen the tip of the iceberg in terms of the cost to date. And we have trillions of dollars that have not yet been paid but have already been obligated. They've already been accrued. So if this were a company, they would be on the balance sheet as deferred compensation. Then the government, because of the way we account for things, these long-term costs are not evident.
Can you elaborate on that when you say that this just started? What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, for example, according to my calculations, we have spent to date on veterans medical care, veterans disability care, and other veterans benefits related to the war, we've spent about $130 billion to date. But if we look over the next 45 years, we know that in today's dollars, we have another $800 billion yet to go, which is already committed. These are veterans who have already been wounded. They've already applied for disability benefits. They've already been granted the disability benefits. So we can project forward, like watching the grass grow. We project that we know that we have another $800 billion to go. So we're just seeing right now, we've just paid the tip of the iceberg, and these costs will go on for decades.
And before we talk more about veterans care, I wanted to ask you the same question, Nita. What are your thoughts about the fact that these astronomical costs are rarely, if ever, part of the debate that politicians are having about the deficit and the budget?
Well, I think they're uncomfortable costs. They take you back to a time when mistakes were made. And also, I think there's an underlying preference to keep the U.S. military budget high. If we talked about the ways that the Iraq and Afghanistan war actually grew the military budget, increased the base spending for the military, then we'd have to question whether or not we need to keep base military spending that high. And given the underlying preference by some politicians to keep military spending high, they don't want to talk about past military spending and how that has, in fact, increased ongoing military spending. So we'd have to have a discussion about current military spending and future military spending, and that is it takes more courage than many politicians have.
Have you heard from any politicians? Have you been in touch with any politicians about the costs of war project?
The line is open.
So that means no.
No.
Wow. Well, so let's talk a little bit about just how to wrap our heads around all of this. And also, I think it's important to really talk about the extent to which the cost of war has been kept off the books of the government's ledgers. This happened regularly under the Bush administration. Can you talk about that, Nita, and put that into context before we dive into the specifics?
Well, one way that the cost of Iraq has been kept off the books is to not look at how it affected the war in Afghanistan, how it, in fact, prolonged and deepened the war in Afghanistan. So, for example, we're spending $100 billion, approximately $96 billion in Iraq-Afghanistan funding this year. But we didn't necessarily have to be in Afghanistan this year, nor would we necessarily have escalated as much in Pakistan. So that's a hidden cost of the war in Iraq. Other costs are, in State Department and Homeland Security spending. So you think about how the State Department has militarized itself, essentially. And that's overseas contingency operation spending that's in the State Department budget. That's a sort of hidden cost.
Mm. And even Watchdog looked at this and found when you factor in all the costs you just mentioned, you're talking about $1.2 trillion a year, so about $100 billion a month. Does that sound about right to you, based on the research you did?
Well, we've spent just, in DOD costs and State Department costs, medical and disability, and so on, the last 10 years, $3.1 trillion.
Okay. So they're basically looking at the military budget overall, $1.2 trillion a year.
Right. Well, it sounds like they're including the base budget, and we can talk about how much of the increase of the base budget should be attributed to spending in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think that must be what they're doing. I haven't seen that study.
Yeah, I think they're including everything. They're putting it all in one pot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That is Nita Crawford. She's professor of political science at Boston University and co-director of the Costs of War Project. This is a nonpartisan, nonprofit initiative based at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. And it's an in-depth look at the implications of wars in terms of human casualties, economic costs, and civil liberties. And you can take a look at it at yourcallradio.org. Linda Bilmes also contributed to this project. She's a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard University, and she is co-author with Professor Joseph Stiglitz of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. And today we are continuing our coverage of the 10-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq by talking about the true costs of these wars. Yesterday we spoke with Iraqis and asked them to reflect. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the true costs of the wars? And why do you think, or what will it take, to get the media and politicians to talk about these issues as they're debating the deficit and the budget? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And how are you reflecting on 10 years of the costs of these wars? Again, you heard Bush administration officials say it would cost $50, $60 billion. But when you factor in benefits owed to soldiers, along with interest, we're talking maybe possibly $6 trillion over the next four decades, according to the new project. You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Rich and Ben Lomond. Hi, Rich. Welcome to the show.
Morning. You know, I'd like to point out, you mentioned a $3 trillion figure. While that's a cost to the American taxpayer, that's profit for bankers and arms manufacturers. And if you think about George W. Bush, he was just that. He was with the Carlyle Group, weapons people. And, for example, George W. Bush's grandfather was one of Adolf Hitler's bankers. So I look to the international bank system as the real problem. And this is just a cost to American citizen that's unnecessary.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment. Nita, what's your response?
I think there are undoubtedly corporations that made money during the war. Some of it was wasted money. There are still corporations making money, like Lockheed Martin will be selling F-16 combat aircraft, or have sold F-16 combat aircraft to Iraq. So we're selling weapons to Iraq. In fact, we're militarizing other areas as well as a consequence of this war. I think, yes, corporations are making money.
And what are your thoughts about accountability? I was just thinking about, is it Paul Brenner? I'm trying to go back in time, and his name is escaping me.
Right.
Who was in charge of so much money that was wasted in Iraq?
Well, the Special Inspector General has found a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse in the occupation and reconstruction. The United States has put $61 billion into reconstruction, about 21% of the reconstruction money, and there is so much more to be done in Iraq. In terms of responsibility, I think of the unintended but foreseeable deaths of Iraqi civilians and their illnesses caused by poor sanitation, lack of access to health care, the fact that the doctors fled and the hospitals were damaged. I think we need to repair all of that, and that's the obligation we have to the Iraqi people. It's not been done.
Oh, I just found an article about this, Paul Bremer, and yes. There was a Guardian piece back in 2005 about $8.8 billion that disappeared. In hindsight, I mean, when you look at what we're facing today, that sounds so low. When you look at how much was wasted. But I'm glad you brought this up, because we had a panel of Iraqis on yesterday talking about the horrible state of the infrastructure. We couldn't even reach one of the women that we've had on over the past 10 years because her phone line is so bad. Electricity is still sporadic. As you said, the sewer system is in shambles. We rarely talk about what the Iraqi people are owed. Can you talk a little bit about that? And what did you look at in the Cost of War project specifically?
Well, we looked at the very big contributors to morbidity and mortality, and a big one is lack of access to health care. There are only 22,000 physicians in Iraq. 18,000 fled after the invasion. A few of them have come back, but yeah, that's 22,000 physicians for a population of 31 million. They've got 84 psychiatrists for a traumatized population. If you just think about the healthcare needs of a traumatized population dealing with amputations and other and wounds from today and all every day continued violence, you think of a population in serious need of assistance.
Well, and just today there were attacks in Baghdad killing 56 and wounding hundreds.
Right. That's another consequence that I mentioned earlier, sort of, you know, bringing terrorism to a country that didn't have it before.
Linda, how do you tackle this question about what the Iraqi people are owed?
Well, I think that the question is not just how much they're owed, but how did we get into a situation where we made such a very substantial mistake that has affected so many people? It has such a major cost to the American people and is such a terrible human cost to the Iraqi people. And Nita Crawford and I have talked about this and talked about the fact that some of these costs cannot be quantified. I mean, for example, you have the hollowing out of the Iraqi middle class, the loss of lawyers, doctors, all of those middle class professionals who make a country work. Many of them, perhaps a million of them, fled to Syria. Now, they are all in terrible situations right now in the middle of the Syrian mess. This is a cost that goes on and on for generations, and a lot of the human cost is unquantifiable.
Did you take a look at Iraq's economy before the invasion? We also talked yesterday about the importance of talking about the sanctions, because these atrocities didn't just start with the invasion. They started with the sanctions. And did you take a look at that, Nita, what the economy was like before?
Well, yes. Some of our scholars have looked at that. I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done. And I'll tell you, the key questions I would ask are, how is it that the consequences of the 1991-92 war, which were not repaired, and then were exacerbated by the sanctions, actually exacerbated the consequences of this war. In other words, we've got 20 and 30 years, you know, Iraq was at war with Iran before 1991. It's 30 years of war. This is a cumulative effect on the population and the infrastructure. Iraq has been ground down. And so, yes, the economy has really suffered. It was a sort of middle class, and, you know, in some ways prosperous authoritarian state.
Well, and now, and you also have massive corruption, a corrupt government, and massive unemployment, especially among young people. So what did the report reveal about the state of Iraq's economy today?
Well, the unemployment is hitting women particularly hard, mm-hmm. and young people as well, and that, you know, education has suffered, and that these facts, in fact, like the poor health care exacerbates the educational problem and vice versa, and that children are stunted and malnourished. They can't take care of their educational needs. They can't learn if they're hungry. And the fact that women are more hungry than men is a problem. In other words, gender inequality has been exacerbated, and the state of Iraq's children is much worse.
And so many women have been widowed because so many men have been killed.
Yes, men, women, and children have all been killed. In fact, if you're hit by an IED, women and children are more likely to die. So everybody is vulnerable. Everybody is, in fact, living with the potential or the actual loss of a limb or a friend or a family member.
Let's take another caller before we go to break. Let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Going forward, do you have any kind of a graphic graphic exhibition of the costs? Where is there some place that perhaps we could plug into online where we could see comparisons of the cost projections going forward? So maybe they could be displayed as numeric constants and variables on a graph.
Yeah, I mean, go to costs, that's plural, costsofwar.org, and there are a number of graphics and papers and a lot of different things there. And Nita, there is a couple nice pie graphs that really show that all of this.
Right, but I think that gives you sort of a static representation, and I agree, it's hard to get the sense of both the costs and consequences through time by looking at a static pie chart. The other thing you can't get from a pie chart is the sense of uncertainty. For example, we talk about 122 to 133,000 direct civilian deaths, but that's deaths that are recorded, right? We don't have any knowledge of the actual number of people killed in Iraq directly by violence, and we haven't been able to graphically represent the people who are killed indirectly by, for instance, damaged water, lack of access to health care, and so on. So I think the pictures would be great, but it's hard to give a sense of the great uncertainty and the need to imagine, and in a way has to be filled by artists and poets, because it's hard to get the extent of what has happened there.
That is Nita Crawford, professor of political science at Boston University, co-director of the Costs of War Project. Professor Linda Bilmes is senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard University. She also contributed to this project, and she's author of the $3 trillion war. Today we are talking about the true costs of the Iraq war. If you have any questions about the costs, we would love to hear from you. How is this going to be paid for? It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
This is your call here on Local Public Radio KALW. To join in today's conversation, call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Programming on Local Public Radio is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Sedaris will visit San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May 5th, for an evening of all-new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com. davidsedarisontour.com.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will speak with Alex Kotlowitz, producer of The Interrupters, a documentary about three violence interrupters working to protect their Chicago communities. They'll be talking about stopping the cycle of violence on urban streets. And you can watch The Interrupters over at the PBS.org website. That conversation will be taking place tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are continuing our coverage of the 10-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. On March 16, 2003, Vice President Dick Cheney said, quote, "We will be greeted as liberators. I think it will go relatively quickly, weeks rather than months," end quote. Well, here we are 10 years later, and on yesterday's show, we spoke with Iraqis asking them to reflect on 10 years of war. On Friday, we're going to dedicate Friday's show to media coverage of the U.S. invasion. And today we're talking about the true costs of the war. The Cost of War Project recently released the human and budgetary costs of the war. It found that the Iraq war has cost $1.7 trillion so far. It actually took a look at Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, and we'll be talking about all of that in total. And we're speaking today with Nita Crawford, professor of political science at Boston University, co-director of the Cost of War Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit initiative based at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. And Professor Linda Bilmes also contributed to the report. She's a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard, and she's co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. And we'd love to hear from you. How are you making sense of the true costs of this war? As we're talking about the budget and the deficit, this is rarely mentioned in media coverage, yet the costs are astronomical. It could grow to $6 trillion over the next four decades. So what will it take to actually talk about these costs? And then also the Bush tax cuts, because that's also connected to all of this. And if you have any questions about the costs of war, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And before the break, Nita, you were talking about the costs of war estimates on the people who've been killed. And there's been such a wide range, everything from 160,000 to over a million, according to Opinion Research, a polling group in Britain. They found that more than 1 million Iraqis have died since the invasion. So what are your thoughts on these different reports and numbers?
Well, the base number is the number of deaths recorded, and that is by media sources and reported. And that's what Iraq body count has. But the recorded, and that's what I'm comfortable saying. I'm comfortable saying that we know that these deaths are, we have names for them, we know who they are and how they died, okay? Then there's a level of violence which was essentially ignored or covered up, not reported. And that we don't have a good handle on. This is because, you know, the U.S. occupiers told the Iraqi Ministry of Health, don't publish these numbers. Stop publishing casualty numbers. And then the Iraqi government had an incentive to look more competent, in fact, than they were at protecting their own people. So the government didn't give out accurate numbers of the killed or the wounded. And then there's a lot of violence, which we just don't really know its causes, but it's war-related in the sense that this violence would not have occurred were it not for Iraq being at war. So yes, there are there's a big range of figures that of people sort of guessing at what this larger unrecorded and war-related violence is. I'm comfortable saying 132,000 people we know for sure were killed in by war's violence, but we also know for sure that that's an undercount.
And Linda, what would you add to that? Do you agree with Nita about how this should be dealt with?
Well, I mean, I'd like to make a couple of points that haven't come out yet, make 3 points. First of all, I mean, we're talking about the war costs, and the issue is what did we get for the money? So we've spent, over the past decade, we've spent between $2 and $3 trillion. And the question is, what did we buy? And what we bought is less security in the region. We bought 6,600 Americans dead. We've bought a legacy of cost of veterans, which goes out for decades. And when you think about that amount of money, we could have turned the region into Switzerland. I mean, it's hard to imagine that kind of money. Just to give you one example, we spent $87 billion in Afghanistan reconstruction, most of which has been, as the Pentagon puts it, has been money on which we have lost visibility. In other words, it's gone down a rat hole and disappeared. Now, that's $87 billion in Iraqi reconstruction. If you think about the National Parks budget, for example, we spend $2.5 billion per year on all the national parks put together. So the first issue is sort of value for money. You know, the second issue is the economic cost of the war and the economic impact of what we have spent. One of the long-lasting repercussions of the war is that oil prices, which were $25 a barrel for decades before we invaded Iraq, went up in the following year to over $100 a barrel and have not come down. And that has been cycling through the economy ever since. And the third point is the financial cost. All of this money that we've been talking about has been borrowed. We've added $2 trillion onto our national debt. That has led to the calls for austerity, the pressure on the U.S. budget, cutbacks across a wide range of things, including the military and national security budget. So we really need to think about the broad impact of the cost of the war. And I think in addition to that, we have the trauma that has occurred in Iraq and in Afghanistan, where you have another generation of people growing up, many of whom will be America haters because of what they have seen and witnessed.
And according to the Costs of War Project, a 2011 survey conservatively estimated that between 800,000 and 1 million Iraqi children have lost one or both parents. So this goes to what you just said, Linda.
I mean, you know, I was had the pleasure of spending a full day last week with General Stanley McChrystal. And General McChrystal refers to what we've created as a huge amount of scar tissue, that our work, that every time we drop a drone, whether or not civilians are actually killed in the attack, there is scar tissue, and that all of the legacy of the war years in the region have left a degree of scar tissue. And out of that scar tissue comes the next generation of terrorists, the next generation of hostilities toward America, and hostilities in the country, in addition to all the widespread human suffering, which is so hard to quantify.
And do you meet with generals on a regular basis?
I do. I mean, I work extensively with the military, with the veterans' hospitals, with veterans, with generals, and with the highest echelons in the Pentagon.
And so what are they saying about all of this and the continuing costs and the drones and the continuing wars?
Well, I think that what they are saying is that there is the legacy, one of the main legacies of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars is to impose very real constraints on the national security budget, which is the subject of my latest paper on this. And this is because there is such an enormous amount of cost that has been added to the structural base of the Pentagon in terms of the personnel cost, the TRICARE healthcare cost, and the base cost in the structure of how the Pentagon is set up, that it is already a third of the cost in the Pentagon. It's growing very rapidly. And this inevitably pushes the Defense Department into a situation where they have to make some trade-offs that they do not necessarily want to make, like trading off the fact that they have to pay higher military pay, benefits, pensions, and health care at a cost of reducing the end strength of our military forces and relying too much on unmanned robotic weaponry.
What did they think about the political theater that we heard or we've been hearing over the past few months about budget cuts to the military on the day that the budget cuts went into effect, also known as sequestration? Lockheed Martin got an almost $7 billion contract for the F-22. It didn't get much media attention, but what do you hear from generals about that?
Well, I think that there is an enormous amount of frustration with the weapons procurement process. One of the effects of the fact that weapons are becoming so expensive is that we're only able to buy a few of them. So we're ending up with an older fleet of ships, older fleet of aircraft, and able to spend less money on things like flight training. And there is an enormous amount of frustration with structure of the Pentagon budget, with the accounting system, which has flunked its audit for the past 20 years, with the lack of transparency in the way the budget is put together, which means that if you are a commander in the military, you can't see where a lot of money is spent. You have to spend your budget every year in order to get funded for next year. There are a lot of incentives that are structured in the wrong way. And all the people I work with are extremely frustrated by the situation.
We have an email from Jane in Fremont who says, a couple of years after the beginning of the war, my husband and I read an article about how much Halliburton shares increased just in the first 2 years of the war. We calculated that Dick Cheney alone, by just steering no-bid contracts to his old company, made a profit of around $16 million. Now consider that Mrs. Cheney sat on the board of Lockheed Martin for a number of years. What are her holdings, and how much did those shares increase due to the war? Well, thanks for the email, Jane. I was just looking this up, and according to Democratic Underground, Lynn Cheney was on the board of Lockheed Martin from 1994 to 2001, for which she was paid $120,000 in compensation every year. Linda or Nita, do you have anything to add about that question?
Well, I also think it's interesting that Lynn Cheney was part of a group after 9/11 that decided that any academics who questioned the United States' response to the 9/11 attacks should be told not to speak about these issues, that we should just defend civilization, and that really, there's a sort of quality of silence which she wanted to promote, when it's exactly free, unfettered debate that will get you to have a true discussion about the likely costs, the foreseeable costs, the consequences, the risks that you take when you try to use force, and that it's not just that the Cheneys made money, the Cheneys didn't want to have a conversation.
Mm. Well, thank you for the email, Jane. And today we are continuing our coverage of the 10-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. We spoke with Iraqis yesterday. We're talking about the costs of the war today. Friday, we'll discuss media coverage. We're joined today by Nita Crawford, professor of political science at Boston University, co-director of the Costs of War Project. You can find a link at our website, yourcallradio.org. It found that the war has cost $1.7 trillion so far. When you factor in benefits owed to soldiers along with interest, the total cost could grow to more than $6 trillion, with a T, over the next four decades. Linda Bilmes is senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard. She also contributed to this project. She's been working on these issues for a number of years. She's co-author of the $3 trillion war. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. How are you reflecting back on 10 years of war when you think about the sheer costs? And when you look at, well, Aaron Glantz was actually just on Fresh Air with Terry Gross talking about how difficult it is for soldiers to get basic health care. So what questions do you have about the costs, and what will it take to add this discussion to the debate about the budget and deficits? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Rod in Oakland. Hi, Rod. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. First of all, let me salute your distinguished guests for their wonderful research. I think it's terrific that they've dug down so deeply. I presume you're going to cover, or you will highlight media coverage and what's happening to our news outlets on Friday. But
yes,
when the topic came up of the cost, and it's been so well illustrated, the cost to the Commonweal, the cost to our defenses, the cost to us as citizens, because we're having to pay this horrific bill. But I would like to just leave this thought, which is, I hope that the karmic cost, will redound to the coterie of connected, corrupt oligarchs from the Bush era. If not for financial shenanigans and skullduggery, perhaps in another 20 years or so, those that are still around will be indicted. You know, it took 30 plus years, and I think it was a Spanish judge who indicted Pinochet. But there's a lot of just horrific behavior that should be, I believe, exposed, and perhaps punishment exacted.
Well,
not in anger, much more in sorrow than in anger. Mm. But you know, the karmic wheel rolls, and perhaps the mills of the gods will grind.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. I mean, it is interesting that we don't really hear much about the Bush administration. Well, George W. Bush specifically, but Dick Cheney was in an HBO special on Saturday night. Condoleezza Rice is at Stanford. She's going to be in conversation with Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg in a couple of days. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has a new book coming out in just a couple of months. Linda, what are your thoughts on this, the question of accountability?
Well, I think that it's interesting that your three last callers have talked about the question of who really profited from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And this is a subject that I've done a fair amount of research on, and there are some surprising findings. And one of the things that has surprised me the most is that in addition to finding enormous increases in profits in the companies that you would expect, such as Blackwater Securities and Halliburton, there are also what may turn out to be larger profiteering among companies that have benefited sort of under the radar screen. For example, if you take the Pentagon top five contractors, which are Boeing and Lockheed Martin and the other large defense contractors, if you took them together, the sixth largest Pentagon contractor would be the healthcare companies, which provide military healthcare, the TRICARE system. Mm-hmm. And these companies grew enormously during the period and profited enormously through the period because of the fact that they were able to negotiate very high fees. They had an enormous surge of service members and families who joined up and used them much more, and they were insulated from any kind of cost controls. Now, this is a cost that sort of keeps on going. So the TRICARE system grew from $18 billion in 2001 to $56 billion in 2013, which is 8% of the total U.S. defense budget. And these are costs that are baked into the system now. They're baked in. So we have baked in a system where those who are eligible for TRICARE can have health insurance provided at a subsidized rate at the same time that the Defense Department is paying over-the-top fees to the companies that are providing the insurance per claim. And when you the further you look into this, the further you realize that there are many companies throughout the country and the world that have sort of been able to profiteer. It's not exactly corruption, but it's sort of profiteering through the war largesse. And this is not surprising when you think about the fact that we've had trillions of dollars swashing around with very, very little scrutiny, because all of this money, which has been appropriated by Congress, has been appropriated through, the vast majority of it, through what's called emergency supplemental appropriations. And these emergency supplemental appropriations are supposed to be for actual emergencies like hurricanes, where the idea is to get the money out the door really, really quickly. So they don't get a lot of scrutiny. So there's been a lot of money forced out the door quickly with a minimal
amount of oversight and scrutiny.
It's interesting you say this because the backlog at the VA does get a lot of media attention, but we don't really hear much about the profits. In fact, you often hear that the VA provides some of the best health care in the country and is able, for example, to get prescription drugs much cheaper than the rest of us. So you don't really hear about the profits of the healthcare industry.
We have to distinguish between two things. There is the veterans, the VA provides medical care through its own system to veterans. Those are people who have left the military, who have been discharged already and have left active duty. There is another system. When you hear about Walter Reed Hospital, for example, that is the military system. That's the TRICARE system, which provides military care to active duty members and their families and to retirees. That's another huge system. Hmm. And there are some retired veterans who get some benefits from both. But it's the TRICARE system, which is a health insurance system. There's a TRICARE system for active duty members. There is another TRICARE system that has been added just for reservists and guards who fought in these wars. There's another TRICARE system that has been added for seniors to supplement Medicare called TRICARE for Life. And all of those are in addition to the VA system.
Wow. Well, and also, Nita, you looked at this in your report. I mean, to think about all of the young people, 18 to 25, I mean, and I know it goes into the 30s, but especially the young people who have suffered from brain damage or lost limbs. I mean, these are the people that would have probably died during Vietnam, but survived in Iraq and Afghanistan because the technology has improved so much over the decades. How do you even wrap your arms around this? Because these people are going to need care for many, many decades to come.
Well, we have arms to wrap around them. Many of them don't have arms. I think it is difficult to fathom, and I think the psychological trauma is, in fact, more insidious, the traumatic brain injuries and traumatic stress, which also ripples out in terms of the care that people need from their families, you know, the watching, the helping with the self-coping mechanisms like alcohol and drug abuse. It will be like Vietnam was, a societal-wide impact for decades to come. Linda is really an expert on that as well, but I wanted to come back to this question of accountability raised by a couple of the callers, if I could,
sure.
Because I think we still have some policies in place as that were used in sort of selling us on the Iraq War and, in fact, on the Afghanistan War that we've seen don't work so well, but we're still trying to apply them. Specifically, we thought that the United States was convinced that if you show that you can defeat dictators and are willing to go take out weapons of mass destruction, whether or not they're actually there, but you're willing to go do it, that North Korea and Iran would roll over to our demands. And we've seen that this doesn't work. In fact, the U.S. invasion arguably made them much more recalcitrant because they had now proof that the United States, in their minds, were aggressors and that they should, in fact, accelerate their programs to get weapons. So we've increased the level of militarization in the world as a consequence of the use of force. So there are these simple sort of formulas that we need to think through. We need to go back and look at what's the reasoning that got us into the war and we thought would work everywhere, actually something that really works.
Well, we have time for just one more call. Oh, Kevin actually dropped. Sorry about that, Kevin. Kevin was calling from Santa Cruz, and he wanted to talk about Republicans and his family losing faith in these policies based on the invasion of Iraq. And I'm sure that a lot of people have similar opinions. We have just a couple of minutes left. Nita, what else do we need to know before we end about the cost of these wars? And do you think that eventually this conversation will make it into the debate about the budget and the deficit? Because we're hearing calls for cuts to Social Security, a rise of the retirement age, continuing shredding of the social safety net.
We need to cut the U.S. military budget. That simple. There are weapons that we're going to buy, that's in the pipeline to buy, to replace weapons that are used in, that were used in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need to think very carefully about whether or not we really need those weapons, and that means we need to think carefully about the role of the United States in the world. does the United States want to continue to try to control everything, everywhere, all the time? It can't do so. Well, then what can we reasonably hope to control? So I think you need to think about what's the role of the U.S., and then let's cut the military budget. It does not need to be this big. Of course, we should keep commitments to active duty soldiers for their pay and health care and to veterans, but let's talk about the rest of it. It's a bloated military for missions that actually don't make us more secure.
And what would you cut exactly? Because we hear this, cut the budget, but what would you cut exactly?
We've got 13 aircraft carriers. Let's cut two. Let's start there. And each aircraft carrier has a number of ships that travel around with it. We can cut those. Okay, that's incredibly expensive. Why do you have aircraft carriers? Because they project your power globally. Do we really need to project American military power globally if it doesn't make us more secure?
And Linda Bilmes, final thoughts from you. We've got about a minute left.
I just want to finally close on just understanding the scale of what we have wrought with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. We have more than 860,000 veterans who have already been treated by the VA. We have more than 250,000 U.S. veterans who suffered a traumatic brain injury. We have thousands of veterans who have suffered amputations. This is a cost that, unfortunately, will be a legacy for decades to come, and that we have created another major long-term cost for the United States without any clear benefits in the operation anywhere else in the world.
And we didn't even have time to talk about the suicides, but 349 active duty soldiers committed suicide last year, almost one a day. And Anita, just quickly, I believe that was the highest suicide toll so far in the last 10 years?
Higher than 2011. It may be the highest active duty suicide, yes.
Wow. Anita Crawford, professor of political science at Boston University, co-director of the Costs of War Project. Linda Bilmes is a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard. She also contributed to the project, and she's co-author of the book, The $3 Trillion War. Linda and Anita, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. And here's what's coming up tomorrow. How do we stop the cycle of violence on urban streets? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Alex Kotlowitz, producer of The Interrupters, a documentary about three violence interrupters working to protect their Chicago communities. We'll also speak with the film's protagonist, Amina Matthews. How much can be accomplished through direct violence interruption? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Have you been part of violence intervention? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.